The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
What inspired me to give this talk was a little bit about the shirt that I'm wearing. Does anyone know whose pirate flag this is, by the way?
Blackbeard.
Bonus. Yes, it is Blackbeard. And I think he is in some ways the most controversial of the pirates because he borders a little bit on terrorists. Like, it's not clear exactly where he is. But my family is from Topsail Island, North Carolina, and their flag is a pirate flag, and they claim Blackbeard as like a native hero. And so growing up, like, their whole thing is like, you know, Blackbeard was all about North Carolina, and the way he was able to be a pirate was actually understanding the very tricky sandbars and terrain of North Carolina. It was actually very difficult to sail in if you weren't from there and you weren't used to the area, and that was one of his big escape mechanisms, is that he would escape down these channels that would then dry up and the British couldn't follow him. So I grew up on kind of the pirate legend stories and the, you know, over yonder was where this happened. And I started reading more about pirates, and in particular about the golden age of piracy, which we're saying in this talk runs from 1650 to 1730. And it made me think about how, as Marxists, we might view the pirates. Like, what is there anything that we take from them historically, inspirationally? So I decided to pitch this talk. Surprisingly, I'm able to give it. And so I brought some of my pirate lore, but I'm also hoping to frame this talk around some actual theories about how we look at outlaws, bandits, groups like pirates, and how we situate them as Marxists in history. So I wanted to start with a definition, and then I actually have some folks who are gonna volunteer to read some biographies from the floor. So if you got one of the biographies, don't volunteer, who were conscripted into reading. I have two questions that are going to frame the talk. The first is, were the pirates social bandits? And I put social bandits in quotation marks because it's actually a theory. The Marxist Eric Hobsbawm has a whole book called Bandits, in which he explores, like, how does Marxism as a theory relate to social banditry? How is social banditry different than banditry? And that's one of the lenses I think it's really helpful to look at the pirates in. Just to define social bandits, he says, and this is a direct quote from his book, "Social bandits are outlaws whom the Lord and state regard as criminals, but who remain within society and are considered by the people as heroes, as champions, avengers, fighters for justice, perhaps even as leaders of liberation, and in any case, as men to be admired, helped, and supported." So that is his general framework for social bandits, and the question I'm hoping we can explore today is, were the pirates social bandits? Were some of the pirates social bandits? Were all of them? It's an open question. And then the second question is, what can we learn about the struggle against imperialism from the pirates? Because regardless of whether or not they fit into this particular theory, certainly they wreaked havoc on a developing global imperialism at a very important time in history. And what can we take from that? So I also am acknowledging the limitations of time in this presentation. So we're gonna kind of paint some things in broad strokes. If you would like to hang out with me afterwards, I have plenty of great pirate stories that will not be shared in this talk, but are awesome and entertaining. And I actually have some folks who are gonna read some of my favorite biographies from the floor, because I think they actually help kind of give us a picture of who some of these folks were. So I believe I have them in order. Mary Read, whoever has Mary Read, can I come hold this for you?
I was born in England in the late 17th century as an illegitimate child. My mom was the widow of a soldier and decided to dress me and treat me as a son, even though I was born female. During the 9 Years' War against France, I joined up in the British military and met and fell in love with a Dutch soldier who discovered I was a woman after I was injured in battle. We moved to Amsterdam and opened a tavern together. He died and decided once again, and I decided once again to seek adventure and donned my male identity and sailed as a crew member to the West Indies. My ship was taken by pirates and I was forced to join their crew. In Nassau in 1720, I met up with successful pirate Calico Jack Rackham and joined his pirate crew. I befriended Jack's partner and fellow female pirate, Anne Bonny, and was open about my true sex. I was notoriously fierce in battle and was often the first to board an enemy ship. I also earned a reputation for being extremely foul-mouthed. In 1721, I was tried and sentenced to die along with my crew members after we were captured by Jamaican authorities. I was pregnant, so I did not hang, but I died in April 1721 from a fever. I was Mary Read.
One of my favorite pirates. Thank you for sharing. Bartholomew Roberts.
That's me. I was the most successful of all the pirate captains of this age, though initially I was a reluctant pirate. I hated my life as a third mate on board the slave ship Princess and was forced to join Howell Davis' crew when he and his pirate force took us captive. Davis, a fellow Welshman, admired my navigation skills and I quickly became respected by his crew. So much so that when he was killed, I was elected captain. I never drank but did not keep my crew from imbibing. I was famous for capturing the most prizes of any other pirate captain and being able to adjust to changing times by operating in both the Caribbean and West Africa. I was eventually killed in battle in 1722 after terrorizing the merchant shipping industry for 3 years. Over 100 of my crew were executed by the British government after my death, and this marked the end of the golden age of piracy. I was quoted as saying the following about why I chose the pirate life. In an honest service, there is thin commons, low wages, and hard labor. In this, plenty and satiety, pleasure and ease, liberty and power, and who would not balance creditor on this side when all the hazard that is run for it, at worst, is only a sour look or two at choking. No, a merry life and a short one shall be my motto. I was Bartholomew Roberts.
Thank you, everyone who's volunteered. Black Caesar is another famous pirate, and then we have a few folks who are going to read biographies of people who brought down the pirates.
I was an 18th century African pirate. I was captured by slave traders in West Africa and was able to organize a successful mutiny when we arrived in Florida. And myself and other liberated slaves formed our own pirate crew and used the small canals and channels of the Florida Keys to evade and capture and hide our small raiding boats. For nearly a decade, I raided shipping from the Florida Keys and later served as one of Captain Blackbeard's chief lieutenants aboard the Queen Anne's Revenge. I was one of the surviving members of Blackbeard's crew following his death at the hands of Lieutenant Robert Maynard in 1718. I was tried and hanged in 1718 in Williamsburg, Virginia. Caesar's Rock, one of the three islands located north of Key Largo, is the present-day site of my original headquarters and was named in my honor. I was Black Caesar.
Woo-hoo. All right. And now we go to the folks who were not so happy about the pirates.
I was a schmuck, no. I was a Puritan minister best known for my role in the Salem witch trials. I can't come into the pirate story because I was in Boston during the time when 9 members of San Bellamy's crew were captured after a ship wrecked off the coast of Cape Cod, and the survivors were found guilty in Boston courts and sentenced to die. I visited all the pirates in their cells and delivered long-winded sermons about their impending eternal damnation. I also proceeded over the hanging of 8 of the pirates, even though none of them wanted me there. I became a hated figure among the pirates for my actions and provoked the wrath of none other than Blackbeard himself, who made it his personal vendetta to torment Boston trade routes in the years that followed. I was Cotton Mather.
Mather. All right, and one more.
I was supposed to be on this one.
Okay. I was the man who developed the British Crown's response to the Great Piracy Outbreak. My family merchant business was devastated by Spanish privateering during the War of Spanish Secession. In 1708, I lobbied my fellow merchants to fund an ambitious privateering mission of our own to raid Spanish shipping in the Pacific Ocean. My 1708-11 privateering expedition circumnavigated the globe, captured a small Manila ship, rescued the castaway, Alexander Selkirk, who was the inspiration for Robinson Crusoe, and made me a household name across the British Isles. It also brought hardship. My brother died in combat, and I took a musket ball to the face. And on returning to England, was bankrupted by a lawsuit brought against me by the East India Company. My infant son died shortly thereafter, and in the aftermath, my marriage ended. My encounters with pirates led me to develop a strategy to defeat them. a combination of carrot, a royal pardon to those who would surrender, and stick, a robust military action against those who would not. I would wind up executing this plan in the Bahamas beginning in 1718. I received a royal commission to act as governor of the Bahamas, so long as I could liberate them from pirate control. My strategy was ultimately successful, ending the pirate republic there and dispersing the remaining pirates across the world, where most of them were picked off one by one. Nonetheless, I was relieved of my governorship in 1722 and wound up in debtor's prison, because that's how the British treat their own, for personal loans I took out to protect the colony from Spanish invasion. My reputation was restored following the publication of A General History of Pirates, spelled with a Y, in 1724. I died in Nassau on July 15th, 1732. I was Woods Rogers.
Awesome. I appreciate everyone's yay, round of applause. I appreciate everyone's willingness. For each of those stories, there are another 5 or 10 that are just as fascinating. I mean, these were fascinating people who lived in a fascinating time. But that was just kind of to whet our appetites a little bit. And to also, those are some of the folks that are going to come up as we go through this as important figures. So first, I want to talk a little bit about the historical period. You have a timeline in front of you. Everyone should have a handout. And if you do not have a handout, you should get one. There are plenty, because I overproduced handouts. The timeline I'm not going to go through. I'm going to actually ask you to interact with it here in a minute. But why do we care about this particular moment in history? It's important not just because it was the moment of pirates, but it was the moment of the beginnings of global imperialism, the rise of the British Empire, the decline of the Spanish Empire, the kind of beginnings of serious European capitalism, primitive accumulation, for those of you who want to use a Marxist term. This is a moment in history where a lot of things are happening, and pirates cannot be understood outside of this. And I'm specifically focusing on the Pirates of the Caribbean, mostly because that's the talk and it's manageable to cover, but also because this particular moment in history, I think, tells us a lot about who these folks were and how we should view them, and also what lessons we should take from them, if any. I also think it's important to think about pirates kind of existing in the space between the cracks in the development of early capitalism. They kind of, you know, I think it's important sometimes we look at big picture and we try to boil everything down to these big theories, but there's also a lot of real meat and interesting things that happen in the space in between. And I think the pirates are kind of situated in the space between this moment before capitalism has fully taken a hold, this moment when there's the decline of one empire and the rise of another, and they kind of fit between the cracks and disrupt it. So in the way you think of like water filling in a cracked vase and how it kind of explodes things, they're able to do that both because of the historical moment, but also what they did. So I like to use that metaphor in thinking about them, because I think it doesn't overstate what they did, but it also kind of shows why they had the impact they did and why we still talk about them and why Disney still spends millions of dollars making movies about them. So social banditry is one lens we're going to be looking at it. I gave you a definition of that. Just to give you a little more background, though, in the theory of social banditry, because I think it's important when we evaluate this. Hobsbawm is a Marxist, so he says bandits and social bandits cannot be understood outside of a study of the historical period in which they operate. We're looking at a period from the late 1600s to the early 1700s. At this time, the main mechanism for expropriating surplus was force, but that force was not necessarily a centralized state force. We still haven't had the complete rise of the nation state. Local power still trumped it in most cases, national power and the nation state, and the ability for the state to have a programmatic policy of state coercion was not yet fully enacted. You see towards the end of this period, the beginnings of that, and the pirates were one of the reasons that developed. One of the reasons why the British came up with a policy of mass executions was because they had to in order to stop and crush the pirates. But it took a while for them to get there. This was not yet the de facto policy. The way we think of state power today, and the way we think of things like the prison system today, and the way we think of how centralized governments operate, and there was a weakness and decentralization to state power in this time. And in certain places, this allowed for the development of pretty serious bandits who were actually able on a local level to challenge state power in their locality. I recommend reading Eric Hobsbawm's book, Bandits. I didn't bring my copy with me, but it's an excellent, it talks a lot about, if you're interested in those spaces between and the cracks. He's an interesting person. He explores a lot of that. Social banditry differs. So a banditry is just those who resist obedience, those who are outside the range of power and are sometimes able to exercise a small amount of power themselves. That's kind of what a bandit is. What makes them a social bandit and what makes social banditry different is a couple of key things. Like bandits, they are regarded by the state or local authorities as outlaws, but they are viewed by other members of the lower class as heroes, avengers, and champions. So they're not just thieves, they are thieves with a purpose. If you think Robin Hood, it's kind of the classic example of the social bandit. In their targeting of the haves on behalf of themselves and other have-nots, they demonstrate resistance to the rich, opposition to foreign conquerors, and the fight against oppression at some level. As we study the Pirates of the Caribbean at this time, we should keep this definition in mind. I think it's a useful one, and I'd love to hear in the discussion what people think about it, whether or not it fits. So I want to explain the map for a minute, just in case folks are not. If you haven't been to the Cayman Islands recently and you haven't been to the Caribbean, it may be, you know, this is the Caribbean. This is the area we're talking about, and there's a couple of interesting things to note. One is that at this time, Europe's over here. The trade winds actually made it pretty hard for you to sail from Europe and not hit one of the Caribbean islands. So the idea that there was some super navigational stuff happening for Europe to reach the Caribbean was not really true. And that's one of the things, like, another reason to discredit Columbus, like, you sail west, you're gonna hit one of these. However, what makes the pirates interesting and why they place such a premium on navigation is that to get from one Caribbean island to another, you actually had to tack against the wind. And so the windward and leeward islands, like which one you were on and where you were going, was actually a difficult thing. And some of the British navigators at the time were not as skilled as the pirates, which was one of the reasons why the pirates were basically able to post themselves in certain places and pick off all of the trade to this region. So it wasn't an accident, it was actually an ecological phenomenon, and the pirates at this point are a little more advanced than some of the traditional merchant sailors. So this map is important. We're going to talk about some of these little islands and different hotbeds of activity, but I wanted to have it up so that people can reference it. So now I actually want to have you interact a little bit more, and I want you to take a serious look at the timeline that I gave to you. So if you don't have one, get it out. Caveat to this talk is that I am a school teacher, so some of this is a little school teacher methodology here. I'd like you to turn and talk to someone sitting near you, and after you've had a moment to read through the timeline, and I'd like you to think about what do you notice and what stands out. Is there any trend that you notice? Is there anything that's particularly interesting? Is there anything that you didn't know that you now know? How might this help frame the talk? So take a few minutes. Converse, read. Don't read too far ahead. We'll get to the other parts of the packet in a minute. And I'd love to hear some shout outs from the audience. Did anybody notice anything? Questions that came up for you? Anything that stood out?
There's no solidarity.
There's no solidarity. Can you explain further what you mean by that?
It's like one for all and all for one here. I'm going to get this entire island, and then we're going to fight for it 10 times.
Yes.
Let's see who gets it.
Yeah, so there's a lot of back and forth between certain countries that seems a little bit petty, and there was also some of that between the pirates, for sure. And there is a big looming question, which is, if the pirates were less individualistic and were able to operate, and there were some pirate crews that actually sailed together, could they have been more of a challenge? I think that's an interesting question, because certainly imperialist countries were still kind of at this, we're rivals, we're friends. Like, they hadn't figured it out yet. And that's partly the moment, again, that we're in history. What else?
And the difference between illegal piracy and privateering, the idea that, of course, if I'm working, you've got the idea that some of them that were pirates were working for nation states, a nation, for that nation, they're perfectly legal, sort of a quasi part of the Navy. For another nation, they're a pirate, but then you also have other pirates that would have been, you're just a pirate because you're not working on behalf of the, so I consider them even lower, like Francis Drake, you're scum, but you're not as much scum because you're at least doing something for your country.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Although Francis Drake is, if you read history books about Sir Francis Drake, first of all, he is considered a hero, yet many of the same things that he did were things that people were hanged for later because it was quote unquote illegal. So under which flag you fly, whether or not you have something called letters of marque, which make you legal or illegal, actually defines you more than your actual actions. Anybody else? Because I'm going to go through a little bit of this, but if anyone else has things to add.
Well, the Disney movies get one thing right, which is that the enemy is the East India Company.
Yes.
You know, and that's what I love about that movie. But because they should go down. But I think what the timeline brings in is the complexity of that, right? That the colonizers are also fighting against each other for doing legal and official robbery.
Right.
And they're fighting against these pirates who are doing illegal robbery.
Right. So let me go through that a little bit. So what was said from the floor, just because the recorder is here, I want to repeat it, was the idea that the Disney movies, one thing they get right is that the evilness of the East India Company. And that's another moment here, which is the rise of these kind of supranational companies that are now taking on the role of acting on behalf of the state around the globe. So the East India Company, the West Africa Company, which is still not fully developed into the monster it becomes later, these are all on the rise. So you have these private companies, you have these burgeoning nation states, and in between all of that, in the cracks, you have the pirates. So let me explain a little bit about this time period in terms of who these different folks were, basically by label. So buccaneers and privateers, those are two different names that are generally synonymous with pirates, and I actually want to argue, if you leave with no knowledge today except for that they are not the same as pirates, that would be a big takeaway from this talk. The buccaneers in some ways were actually, I think, a more interesting period to explore because they were mostly land-based and they were actually escaped convicts and slaves for the most part from the plantations in Haiti. So if you go back and trace back the Haitian Revolution, but there are many buccaneers that may have sown the seeds for that in their raids on Spanish plantations. A lot of them lived in the hills. The term buccaneer is actually a slang term from a French phrase called roasted meat, because you would smell them roasting meat, and that was the only way you knew they were there, because they were so hidden and kind of in the jungles. They were living in the wilds. They weren't necessarily sea-based, so they certainly had ways of getting around, but they were mostly based in particular actual land formations. So the idea that buccaneers has become pirates, that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers use a pirate thing, it's not really historically accurate. The privateers were mostly English, but there were some Dutch and French, and these were what I would call legal sanctioned pirates. So these were the pirates who were actually employed by their governments to raid other government ships. And they were given something called letters of marque. And they would raid only ships that were not their own countries. Henry Morgan is the most famous of these. Sir Francis Drake was an earlier version from the 1560s. Henry Morgan, in many ways, behaved like a pirate, but as a privateer, he only raided ships that were hostile to the British government. And he ended up being knighted. If you look at the timeline, he had a little bit of a back and forth with King Charles II, where he was arrested, released, knighted, died, got a state funeral. It was a little hard to figure out exactly where he should be. Also, an interesting note around the buccaneers, and something I'm not going to talk about, but if people would like to bring it up from the floor, is the question of homosexuality in pirates. That's a whole other talk, and there are several books about it. The buccaneers actually were male partners. They would partner off, and they would have a male partner who would be responsible for them and their well-being. And when they went off into the jungle, the same way that you think of like taking kids on a field trip, where's your buddy? Make sure your buddy's okay, because they would often scatter and then reform. So there's a whole lot of stuff written about what that meant to be male partners. I'm not going to go into that. There's also a lot to say about Madagascar and the pirating that happens in the Indian Ocean, particularly around the East India Company. It happens at a particular moment when there's peace treaties between some of these warring nations, and the pirates have to go elsewhere. And then they start to target companies like the British East India Company, because they can target a company rather than a government. I'm not going to talk much about them, but there's some really interesting stuff. And then the War of Spanish Succession breaks out, and that's what brings the pirates back to the Caribbean. Because again, many of them are hired as privateers to poach Spanish ships, and there's a unity between the French, the Dutch, between the Dutch and the English against the French and the Spanish, and there becomes this kind of hotbed of pirate activity post-1700. So there's, you know, England versus Spain, England versus France, England, France, and the Netherlands versus Spain, the scramble for colonial power. What we can say is that the Spanish Empire is on the decline, and that's one of the ways that Henry Morgan was incredibly successful. He basically took down the major ports of the Spanish main with very little resistance. And Spain had no answer to him because they'd never seen war tactics like this. Things like lighting a ship on fire and sailing it into a harbor. They shoot all their cannons at you, they're out of ammo, and then you sail in and take it. And people had not yet experienced that. Spain was not ready to be challenged and defend. So you see this kind of scramble of like, there's an opening now and we can conquer all of this wealth. And the Spanish treasure fleet at this time was still, you know, the epitome of what people wanted, the gold and silver that was being robbed from native people in the quote unquote New World was still the prize of the age. And so that is the backdrop to all of this. I'm not gonna say that much about the rise of slavery. That is again a whole nother topic, but I will say this, that slavers made some of the fiercest pirates, so people who were actually sailors on slave ships, partly because the conditions on the slave ships for both the sailors and obviously for the slaves, I mean, that goes without saying, but the actual conditions for the sailors were some of the harshest. So being a merchant sailor at this time was a terrible, terrible job. You had a tyrannical captain, you were underfed, you were not paid, in some cases ever, but certainly not paid until you returned. You were away from your home for years and years and years, and many, many people died. And this is partly the social condition that produces piracy as well, is that anything is better than this. And on the slave ships, some of those conditions were even worse. And so you actually see a series of pirates being formed by the mutiny on slave ships. And I'll get to later what happens in that situation in terms of the question of oppression and the resistance of slavery, because I think that's an interesting one. So the social conditions of the sailors, the imperial conditions of the world, these are all things in which this kind of moment in history is able to happen. By the way, I didn't say this before, but this flag here is one of my favorites, and if anyone can tell me whose it is and why it might be one of my favorites, I will be very excited to hear. And I will tell you at the end, but think about it. Think if you recognize it. All right, so now I'm gonna move into were they social bandits or were they just bandits? Because I think we can overly romanticize them, and I think certain authors do. I think we can also underplay the role they had in shaping consciousness at the time. So where do we situate them? So I'm going to go through a series of questions, and you are certainly welcome to disagree with me on these questions and discussion. I am by no means an expert, but I think it helps frame the discussion. So how democratic and consciously anti-authority were the pirates and pirate culture? I think there's a lot to be said about that, and people often hold it up as like pirates were floating democracies. Well, yes and no. So how were the crews actually organized? I included in your packet the articles of Bartholomew Roberts. One of the reasons we have these articles is because, as we heard from Bartholomew Roberts earlier, he was killed and over 100 of his men were executed, and his ship was basically taken wholesale and everything from it was taken. And so the general history of the pirates written by Captain Charles Johnson, aka Daniel Defoe, many people think it's actually written by Daniel Defoe because there's a lot in it that's not true. He basically based almost the entire history of pirates on like backwards mapping from what they found on Roberts' ship. So Roberts is one of the pirates that we know the most about because of the way he was brought down. His articles are not that unusual. Besides some of the strictness around gambling, they were pretty democratic. So if you look those over, those are basically what you would sign on to if you wanted to be a pirate on his ship. So the articles were created by a council that would usually sit around a giant bowl of punch. So there was some drinking involved. People would throw out ideas, they would create articles, and then if you wanted to join the crew, those articles were what you signed on for. A couple of things that I think are incredibly important about these. One is that they were actually created in a democratic fashion. There were some strict rules, but those strict rules were related to things that would actually cause damage to the ship and possibly light them on fire and things like that. So if you look at some of the harshest, they, you know, absolutely no matches below decks. Like, yes, because we cannot blow ourselves up. That would be a problem, especially if we're all drinking heavily. Like, you can imagine. The use of counsel to actually decide guilt on these and punishments was another aspect. So the council would take these articles, and if someone was found in violation, the council, that means all of the pirates on the ship sitting around in a circle, would discuss the guilt or innocence of the person and decide an appropriate punishment. It was not a single person in charge. There was, however, a person called the quartermaster who was basically not the captain, but the person who carried through the articles. So they would be the person who handed out the food, the person who divided up the spoils of a particular capture. They were seen as kind of a neutral figure. And so in that way, the captain was not the powerful figure that they were on regular merchant ships. Another interesting thing in the pirate articles is early disability insurance. I don't know if you noticed on there, but should you lose a limb in battle or another part of your body, you get paid out. Why? One, because it makes you fight harder. If you know if you get injured, you're going to get money for it. But also the idea of like collective responsibility for the whole. There was definitely this sense of like, you know, all for one for all, the musketeer type attitude. There was democracy certainly in decisions. There were council meetings often. Captains were elected and immediately accountable. The captain's quarters were open to all. So if you imagine, if you've ever been on a ship of this kind, there's usually like a really nice area where the captain lives and everyone else lives somewhere else or below decks or on decks. The ships were often reformatted so that the walls, even between the captain's quarters and the rest of the ship, were taken down. And anybody could go in and eat, get whatever, I mean, use whatever materials were there, look at the maps. It was an open culture. So in many ways, that does feel very democratic. I think the question, though, is like, was pirate consciousness democratic and explicitly anti-authoritarian? Like, did they consciously develop this as a way to say we want to be more democratic? Or was this just the best way that they could think of to live together and not, you know, have conflicts they couldn't solve? I guess in the question of anti-authoritarianism, certainly the pirates in their actions were very anti-authority and were incredibly disruptive of trade and the profit-making of the rich. How much they did that with a conscious attitude of like, we're going after you, there's certainly examples. Blackbeard is actually one of the most explicitly anti-authoritarian. This is also where you could say he's a little bit of kind of a terrorist because some of the stuff he did was a little extreme, both to his own crew and to some of the local governments. But he was so incensed by Cotton Mather and what he said to Sam Bellamy's captured soldier or captured pirates that he basically terrorized Boston Harbor for months on end out of spite. He blockaded Charleston, South Carolina in order to demand medicine for his crew, and he refused to let up until they sent out stores of medicine. He took on Governor Spotswood from Virginia in like a personal vendetta, so much so that Governor Spotswood was afraid to leave the colony of Virginia for fear that he would be hunted down and killed by Blackbeard. Because they had heard all these stories about what happens if you are captured on, if you are captured by the pirates and you are not a nice person or you treat your crew unfairly, all number of horrible things would happen to you. And in fact, that is one of the anti-authoritarian things that we most take from the pirates. The way they treated captains who were unfair versus captains who they deemed fair. So it wasn't a blatant, like, all captains are bad. They would interview crew members of captured vessels to find out whether or not these merchant captains were decent and treated people with respect on their crew or not. And if they weren't, many times they were killed outright or tortured. If they were seen as decent, they were often let go. And in some cases, retained their ship empty of cargo. I think another place to look at in terms of trying to get our hands on or a handle on what pirate consciousness was is to look at the final speeches of some of the pirates. And that's something that Villains of All Nations actually has some excellent excerpts of pirate speeches. So as you are going to the gallows, what are your dying words? And many of them actually painted a very coherent picture of, I'm very sad to be dying, But I'm also like, F you to the authorities. And Cotton Mather, get out of my face. And I have no regrets. And I lived a free man, even if it was only for a couple of years. And certainly we could say the pirate captains were much more egalitarian than any of the Navy or merchant captains at the time. Okay, so another key question. So again, I'm not gonna say yes or no. I'm gonna kind of give you some evidence and let you figure out for yourself how democratic were the pirates. How socially conscious were they? I think this is where we get into an interesting debate. What did pirates have to say about oppression, and how did they behave around oppression? Because I think this is where some of the social banditry question gets a little muddy. So first of all, I want to go through what the status of, were the pirates international? I want to talk about the status of slaves in pirate culture, and I want to talk about women. And particularly women pirates, but also how pirates interacted with women. So internationalism, pirate crews were almost all multinational and had crew members from Europe, mostly from England, Ireland, Wales, some from France, Spain, the Netherlands. They also had folks from Africa, India, and the American colonies, and some pirate crews were actually Canadian. After 1715, most pirate crews were English-speaking and consisted mostly of English pirates. However, there were constantly this multinational feel to a pirate crew. And in many ways, nationality did not get in the way of whether or not you were allowed to join. So there was a kind of open policy. However, I think there's a really interesting quote from this book. Let's see if I can find it. Sorry, page 15. Sorry. This is an excellent book, by the way. I have a book list in there. David Cordingly is one of the best experts on pirates, and he's not very overly romanticizing of them, but he has a lot of facts. So one of the things he says, is that the pirates shared the same prejudices as other white men in the Western world at this time. To me, I can't highlight that statement enough. The idea that somehow they had leaped over all of the prejudices against people of different nationalities, against slaves, against women, they shared the same prejudices. In some ways, their social conditions led them to challenge them, in other ways, not. So now I want to talk about slaves, because I think that is where we start to see how not so socially conscious or against oppression the pirates were. And I can't go into this too much, but I encourage people to bring it up from the floor. So Black Caesar is an example of a former slave who was a leader in Blackbeard's crew. He was respected. He was a major pirate figure. There are a few black pirates who established themselves as major active pirates who were respected by their crews, who we hear their stories. There were many, many examples of slave ships mutinying and becoming pirate ships. However, there are some of those slave ships that mutinied and the slaves were set free or allowed to join the pirate crew. And then in others, the slaves were actually sold as part of the cargo. And so I think you see there the mixed consciousness of the pirate culture. And, you know, for as many examples of liberation, there were also examples of things that we would be wholeheartedly against. And in fact, the slave ships were where most of the mutinies happened after 1710, and many of them, unfortunately, went on to sell their slaves and reap their profits, so the crews did not actually liberate the slaves. And they shared the same prejudices as other white men in the Western world. I would say that statement is true with the role of women. So we have Anne Bonny and Mary Read, who are the two most famous female pirates. There are a couple other famous female pirates, but they were not seen or treated as equals in pirate society. Roberts didn't even allow women on board. You see that in his articles. No women, no boys. I mean, read into that what you want, but it basically, none of that. Pirates were almost exclusively unmarried. They enjoyed a variety of open relationships with both prostitutes and girlfriends in various ports in which they went to call. There's evidence that some pirates even used rape as a form of torture on the ships that they captured, particularly if you look at the pirates in Madagascar and the Indian Ocean. There are endless examples of them raping Indian merchant ships. There were women on board who were passengers, and using that as a way of social control. So in that way, we could say many of the pirates were actually incredibly backwards in their social consciousness, in particular towards women and other oppressed groups. Okay, so I want to close up here, and I'm sorry, I know I've been going a little bit. Okay. So what was their popular appeal? I think this is an easier question to answer. We need to understand, though, that this moment there's also a radicalism that's shaping Europe at this time. We are not too many years out from England actually chopping off the head of Charles I and the uprising of Cromwell and the Roundheads in England, which in many ways shaped those who became pirates, shaped their consciousness, and shaped the people who ended up colonizing and becoming the United States. So Britain was developing into a global superpower at the same time that they were kind of dealing with this legacy of radicalism. And Britain put a premium on developing a strong navy to protect its assets abroad because it was starting to realize that they had just sent a bunch of angry convicts to America and expected them to behave. So if you think about things like Bacon's Rebellion and you start to see some problems with the strategy of, oh, we send them over there, we give them a piece of paper that tells them how to behave, and they'll just behave. And the pirates, in many ways, were like the most violent kind of resistance, but there was certainly resistance in the American colonies as well. There are many examples of pirates directly challenging petty tyrants in the area. There's some really excellent stories about them challenging the West African Company, and in some ways those are the pettiest of tyrants. I mean, these were folks who literally were letting people starve around them while ordering dresses from France for their children, and the pirates would just ruthlessly attack them. So I encourage people to read more about those stories. Rich merchants in the imperialist state were always frequent targets. Like I said about the captains, if you were deemed a bad captain, you were given extreme punishment. Blackbeard and Cotton Mather is a famous feud. Blackbeard also challenged the government of the Carolinas and Governor Spotswood, like I said, who was afraid to travel for fear he would be taken down. However, because pirates weren't based on a particular agrarian land formation like the social bandits that Hobsbawm describes mostly in his book, it's hard to say they had a base of supporters. So while they may have had popular appeal and while people loved to read about the pirate stories in the latest newspaper, they weren't necessarily a rallying point for resistance among the peasants who were occupying the American colonies or the slaves or peasants who lived in the Caribbean. Those folks were getting their ideas about resistance from themselves, not necessarily from the pirates. So they had no real base of supporters. I think that makes the analogy about how popular appeal is a little difficult. And even though they had bases in Jamaica and the Bahamas, and those were welcoming ports, so those, you know, the Jamaica first and then the Bahamas later became kind of pirate havens. They really weren't kind of agrarian societies of peasants living there. They were actually mostly like small communities of taverns and places of trade. So it's a little different than what the social banditry theory operates under. They were incredibly disruptive of trade and of the naval dominance in the sea, but they didn't have a real impact on the daily lives of ordinary people who were living in the colonies at this time or who were living in the Caribbean. And one key example, back to Woods Rogers, who is a fascinating character. Even though he's on the wrong side, there's some moments where you're like, God, you're just a fascinating character. Like, your life was so hard, and yet you still, you know, did what you needed to do for the British Empire. And in some ways, he was the only man who could bring down the pirates because he was himself a privateer. So he knew how they operated. He actually, when he first arrived in the Caribbean, rounded up about 50 pirates and executed them. And it was a very bold move because at this time, no one had gotten away with mass executions of pirates. They had all, you know, the pirates had come in and basically stopped any execution of their brethren. And he literally stands on the scaffold with them and says, if any of you here in Jamaica want to rise up and take them down, come get them. Like, to the citizens of the town, there, you know, maybe 800 people came out to see the execution. And he literally challenges them and knows at that moment that if they take down the gallows, he is probably going to be killed. And not a one kind of rallies to the support of these 50 pirates. So I think in some ways we see that while they were inspirational and exciting to hear about, they didn't really have a social base among the impoverished people who were living on land at this time. And, you know, what would have happened if they had taken him down? I don't know. So what is their legacy? I think there are some positive things we can take. The spirit of internationalism, the idea of freedom from oppression, And the idea of a free and short life, as Bartholomew Roberts said, a short but merry life, free from the fetters of society, is what I would choose over degradation and being humiliated and being treated as less than. They created their own rules. They lived outside the fetters of morality and of society. It was by no means an easy life, and they did not take that choice lightly. And in many ways, we can take inspiration from them. It was, you know, you could say, how self-serving was that? How much of it was noble? I don't know. That's for discussion. They also, as we look at them as Marxists, were a real challenge to the status quo, which is why they had to be crushed, which is why the British government had to buy them off with a pardon or execute them. And that is what they did. And that is what brought them down. It was not, they faded away into history. They were ruthlessly, ruthlessly crushed. And I think it's important to say that they represented that big of a threat, and that that is something that we can take away as how do we fight global imperialism. So, in closing, I want to read a quote. Actually, you know what? I'll save the quote for the wrap-up. Can I read the quote? Anybody, though, in closing, this is one of my favorite flags. I think it represents, in some ways, the mixed consciousness of the pirates. Does anybody know whose flag it is? It was one of the people who read a bio at the beginning.
It's a Black Caesar.
It's Bartholomew Roberts. And this was actually his second flag. And he, this is him. And he is literally standing on the heads of the governor of Martinique and the governor of Bermuda, who were two people who pissed him off. And so I love that you make this entire creation that you fly above that basically is like, I will stomp on your dead skulls. So if there's anything we can take, they certainly were creative artists.
Are those the initials?
Those are the initials of the governors. So, yeah, so you can imagine how many of us would like to create this flag today, and whose heads would we put under our feet? It's kind of an, you know, exciting moment. All right, so that is it. I hope we can have a discussion about what people think about what I just presented, and I'm sorry that I ran a little over time.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.